This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Most, if not all, states offer some kind of incentives to entice businesses to set up shop and then to stay in state, not to move to New Hampshire or California or China. But those incentives vary widely, from tax breaks to cash boosts. One of the ways Vermont tries to get businesses to continue investing in the state and to create new jobs is through something called the Enterprise Investment Fund. Governor Peter Shumlin trumpeted the success of the fund in his State of the State speech this year.
In the race to the bottom, where states cannibalize each other for jobs, Vermont has succeeded by being smart, not big. 2 years ago, we added to our job creation arsenal the Vermont Enterprise Fund. And in my budget, I will ask you to enhance and extend it because of our job creating successes. This tool has helped us create 70 new manufacturing jobs at GW Plastics in Royalton. I'm proud to announce today that BHS Composites of Sherbrooke, Quebec, is expanding to Vermont with 75 new manufacturing jobs in St. Johnsbury thanks to the Enterprise Fund.
But not everyone is convinced of its need or effectiveness. They question why we're giving state money to private businesses and say the process isn't transparent enough. The state auditor is among those questioning the fund. We're joined now by Doug Hoffer. Auditor Hoffer, thanks for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
How would you characterize the Enterprise Fund?
Well, I need to be careful here. It's not my job to weigh in too much on the policy. But in fact, the statute that created the fund asks, among other things, the emergency board, when considering the proposal from the governor, whether there is sufficient information provided to allow the state auditor to conduct a performance audit. So in all three cases, I've done that. And in all three cases, the answer was no.
Because the emergency board is what decides on delivering the award to a company after a request made by the governor.
Correct. And that's one of my concerns. The emergency board, by definition, is about emergencies. And the statute characterizes the Enterprise Fund as a rapid response mechanism. In my, based on the information provided to me, none of these three cases were emergencies.
And so you were trying to look into what exactly, what the awards actually got us or how they were awarded?
No, the question is there sufficient information to conduct a performance audit? And specifically what that means is that to come to a conclusion about information presented, in any case, it doesn't have to be this particular subject, an auditor needs sufficient and adequate information. Those two terms have a meaning in audit world, and that is sufficient is quantity and appropriate is quality. So I had to look at the memos provided by the governor's office, I think prepared primarily by the Agency of Commerce, as to whether claims and statements made in them were supported by evidence. And in most cases, they were not.
So you can't actually do an audit on the Enterprise Fund is the
point. That's the point. You can't do it. It can't be done. And furthermore, the real fundamental issue, and there is no but-for requirement for this program as there is for veggie, but that still lingers in the gray area here, and that is what would have happened absent these funds. Now, we already know in the case of Global Foundries, they already announced that they were going to make that $55 million investment. That was months ago. But there was a couple of other concerns. Also, the memos are provided to the four members of the emergency board, and they are expected to make a decision usually within a week. That doesn't leave them much time to evaluate the proposals or ask for additional information, and that's especially true during the legislative session. Those four people are chairs of the busiest committees in the building. Furthermore, the Enterprise Fund is not a program per se. There are no wage requirements, as is the case for veggie. There's no consideration of background growth, and the recapture provisions are weak and ad hoc. And finally, another concern I have is that notwithstanding the Agency of Commerce's mission and desire to be of help, they are clearly not an objective source of information. They are an advocate, yet they are the source of this information. And in my review of those three memos, there were some problems, both with due diligence and the reliability of the data.
So what would make it better for you? What would you like to see that would actually make it a program that you could audit and that you think would pass that transparency test?
Well, they'd have to provide the information necessary for any auditor to review the claims made by the agency on behalf of these companies and or give access to company records, and that's not going to happen.
In that case, if you say that's not going to happen, do you think the enterprise fund is unethical? Should it be dissolved?
I didn't say it was unethical.
No, that's my question for you.
No, it's not a matter of ethics. It's a matter of whether it's an appropriate use of funds. And if you have a program that is spending millions of dollars, yet it cannot be audited, I think that's a problem. The fact is, you know, we have an incentive program for businesses. A lot of money is going out the door these days through the Veggie program and others. And I'm not convinced, although this we haven't audited this question, but I'm not convinced that this enterprise fund is necessary.
So, again, you're not convinced this is necessary. You've come out with memos that you have sent out, but not to the public, right? You can't actually make you're telling us what you're finding and what you haven't been able to find, but you can't actually release what you did because these aren't audits.
Well, no, I can't release them because they deal with information that was provided and is claimed as confidential, although I don't even buy that because the last one for GlobalFoundries, virtually every data point mentioned in the memo was discussed in open session of the e-board. But so I am bound by the confidentiality rules.
It sounds, Auditor Hoffer, like you're quite frustrated. Is that an accurate reading of your tone?
Well, frustration is not my default setting, but in this case, I think it's misguided. I hope the legislature has a thoughtful conversation about this. I know the governor is very supportive of it, and I can appreciate that. But if we can't be provided with sufficient information to answer straightforward questions about claims made in the memos, then the legislature just has to know that going forward. Because the memos say things about, if we don't do this, these are the things that will happen. And because we're doing this, these are the things that are going to happen. Those are assertions. They are not facts unless they are supported by evidence. So if the legislature is comfortable with a program with so little hard information, then it's their choice. They can make that decision, but I would recommend against it.
That's Doug Hoffer. He's Vermont's Auditor of Accounts. Thank you very much for sharing your perspective today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We are talking about the Vermont Enterprise Investment Fund. It's an incentive fund that distributes money to companies to help them grow their businesses and increase jobs in the state. As Auditor Hoffer mentioned, it's designed to be a rapid response. And Doug Hoffer was also mentioning Veggie. That's the Vermont Employment Growth Incentive, which is also an economic incentive for business growth and expansion. Separate programs, the Vermont Enterprise Investment Fund is the one we're looking specifically at today. We're trying to see why it exists, if it should keep operating the way it does now or at all. And you can share your thoughts with us. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm joined in the studio now by Commerce Secretary Patricia Moulton and by Paul Cielo, President and Executive Director of the Public Assets Institute, to continue this conversation. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much, Jane. It's great to be here.
So, Pat Moulton, Doug Hoffer raised some questions about you. You're actually the department that's sending out or delivering why the fund is giving money to these businesses and what the claim is about why it's necessary. So he says there's not enough information to back up those claims and to prove that it's necessary. Why can't you give more information?
Well, I think the auditor is perhaps premature in his assessment because some of this information will be available as these companies undertake their expansion projects, specifically in the case of GlobalFoundries. They will not receive funding until after certain measures are met, and we will have documentation about those measures. The same is true of other firms, GW Plastics and BHS Composites. There'll be documentation as they proceed with their project. So I think his assessment is just too early. It is his job to audit the program, and at the time he's ready to do a program audit, we will have material available for him.
Why not provide that material, though, when you can to the legislature and to the emergency board, which is supposed to decide on whether or not to award these grants?
These are incentives offered in advance of a project. So the companies say, I will create 75 jobs. We cannot document the creation of those 75 jobs until the jobs are actually created. GlobalFoundries, I will make these investments. We cannot document the investment until it's made. So it's not at all unusual that these kinds of programs and incentives are offered in advance of a project. project, that's when a company is still contemplating whether or not the project's going to happen here in Vermont or whether it's going to happen in substantively the same way, which is one of the measures of the Vermont Employment Growth Incentive.
How much money was awarded to GW Plastics?
Approximately $500,000 was appropriated or awarded to GW Plastics to facilitate their expansion in Royalton and the creation of 73 jobs. They are one of the anchor tenants in the Royalton area. They hire high school graduates as well as advanced degree graduates, and a huge opportunity for this homegrown 60-year-old business to continue to grow in Vermont instead of Texas or Arizona, where they have other plans. And frankly, where they're pretty clear that they have a greater workforce availability. But we were able to, with these incentives, convince them to undertake that expansion here.
And BHS Composites, for the claim that they'll grow 75 jobs in Vermont in the St. Johnsbury area, how much money was awarded to them?
$200,000 to BHS Composites. These and as the auditor and others know, these are funds on top of Vermont Employment Growth Incentive. So, and
the veggie program.
Right. And the legislation is clear in some cases that we have to demonstrate they're eligible for other incentives. But those 75 new jobs in St. Johnsbury are going to be very valuable for the kingdom, where we historically see high unemployment and low wage jobs. These are going to be good jobs, family owned company. The daughter, as my understanding, is going to be running the plant here in St. Johnsbury. And so it's a real nice win for us. And they were considering New Hampshire. And one of the benefits that New Hampshire had is a larger facility that they recognize here in Vermont. They're probably going to need to expand their facility fairly soon after they occupy. And that was one of the concerns, is the cost of expansion. And these funds were able to offset for that company some of those costs and enable them to undergo their expansion here.
We're also going to talk about the $1 million that was announced for Global Foundries for their Essex fabrication plant, and we'll go into that in more detail in just a moment. But Paul Cielo, I want to bring you into the conversation. What's your perspective on the Vermont Enterprise Investment Fund and if it is a good use of state money?
Yeah. Thank you, Jane. Well, first of all, I think the Vermont the Enterprise Investment Fund is part of a package of an approach that the state uses that other states use, which is to use public money to entice businesses to either stay or come to Vermont. And in general, we think that that's not a good strategy for a couple of reasons. One is that it takes money away from we have limited resources in the state, tight budgets, and it takes money away from investments that all Vermonters could benefit from, and that it focuses on a few businesses that happen to be lucky enough to actually get the tax credits or, in this case, a payment from the fund. And the other thing is that the history is that it doesn't work very well. It in terms of making investment, giving money to individual businesses, the track record over the last 15 years is that we haven't grown that many jobs.
And not the track record, we should say, of the Vermont Enterprise Investment Fund, because that was just created. But you mean these incentive funds?
Of the whole
like
strategy.
Veggie.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I would call it business financial incentives. And that's right. So that approach hasn't, when you look over the last 15 years and you look at Vermont's anemic job growth, it's not a great credit to the strategy that we've been using in Vermont. So what we would like to see is a shift in an approach that the Vermont uses, where we actually use public money to make investments in Vermont as opposed to in individual businesses. And because Vermont's going to be here, we don't know whether these businesses are going to be here going forward. So if we make the investments in Vermont in things like transportation, in high-speed internet, in education, then that whatever businesses grow in the state have opportunity to use those investments as opposed to investments that go to individual businesses.
Secretary Moulton, I know you want to jump in here, but let me just ask Paul Cielo before we go back to the secretary. Couldn't it be argued that Vermont just doesn't offer enough incentives? Because as we said, I mean, everybody offers incentives, and we keep hearing that a state like New York can offer way more than Vermont can, and that could attract businesses there. So could it be argued rather than let's just ditch incentives, maybe we should be piling on more if we want to attract more business to the state?
One certainly could argue that, and actually I'm sure people have. The problem is that the more money you put into this, the more money you're taking away from investments that actually can benefit all the people in Vermont. And besides, Vermont is a small state in this and really isn't going to compete in this race with New York or Massachusetts in terms of providing those kind of incentives. The other thing I should add is that what we're talking about is a very small number of businesses that actually cross state lines. And it's like 1% in Vermont. I think the studies show it's like 1% to 4% in all states. But in Vermont, it's about 1% that actually cross state lines to locate here. So most of what happens is homegrown. It's individuals that, for whatever reason, want to be in Vermont. This is their home, and then they start a business. And a lot of businesses fail. And so that's why it's important that we have a state infrastructure that can support that kind of business development. So businesses come and go, but the ones that survive actually have a supportive environment. And we're talking about schools. We're talking about, employees, the job training, that sort of thing.
Secretary Moulton?
Well, this is an area where Paul might be surprised that we agree. And I, and as the governor spoke, the incentive game is a race to the bottom. But until the 49 other states decide they're not going to play this game, we've got to be in the game. And Paul's also right. Vermont will never compete with the scale of incentives that larger states with larger populations can hand out. We were competing for a company that ended up in Buffalo, New York, because of $97 million in incentives the state of New York was able to offer that company. We know and have heard recently that Global Foundries in their East Fishkill plant has had some $12 million in operating expenses simply eliminated, property taxes and energy costs, by the state of New York. That's not what we are. That's not what we do here in Vermont. But we do have an incentive package through the Vermont Employment Growth Incentive and the Vermont Enterprise Fund that are tools that help us. And the VEGGIE program in particular, funds are not awarded unless companies meet the performance measures, unless they meet the job creation. They're one job short. They don't get the incentive. Likewise, they're 10 jobs over their projection. They only get the incentive they applied for. We have one of the better rated incentive programs, and that's great. And the Enterprise Fund, like a lot of states have what they call closing funds, is a nimble resource that governors can use to sweeten the pot, if you will, to help be the element that tips the scales and on behalf of Vermont and helps assure that job creation happens here and for Vermonters. And I think what Vermonters want us to do is retain and create jobs. And that's exactly what this Enterprise Fund provides us with, another tool to do that.
We are talking about the Vermont Enterprise Investment Fund today. It's a state-sponsored incentive program for creating new jobs. Coming up, we're going to look at a recent award to Global Foundries that left some people questioning how the fund is being used, how that money is being distributed. Also, some defense of it that we'll also hear. And we're getting notes from you. Joe says, I don't want to belittle the impact Global Foundries has on our economy, but no state should be allowed to give taxpayer money or tax discounts to corporations. Give the tax breaks to Vermonters or stop cutting state government services. Andrew responded right to Joe's post, though, saying, maybe, but what tax money is there if there are no companies and businesses to tax? So we're going to be looking at that perspective, that idea of incentives, as well as a little bit more deeply into the money that was just granted to Global Foundries coming up. And if you'd like to share your thoughts or ask a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Patricia Moulton is Secretary of the Agency of Commerce and Community Development. Paul Cielo leads the Public Assets Institute. Together, we're talking about the Vermont Enterprise Incentive Fund, a pool of money, state money, designed to be rapidly deployed to help businesses in the state implement projects that need to create new jobs. Not everyone thinks the fund is a good idea or that the money is being distributed in a fair and transparent way, so we're discussing that today. And if you have a question or if you'd like to share share your thoughts. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I also misspoke. It's the Vermont Enterprise Investment Fund, not Incentive Fund. Am I right there, Pat?
Actually, the statute says it's the Vermont Enterprise Fund.
So. Got it. So we can take out the I altogether, although it keeps being called VEIC. So Vermont Enterprise Fund. There we go. Make it easy. Let me just ask you about this money that was just awarded, $1 million. This fund, as I understand it, was originally created a couple years ago partly to try to keep IBM in Essex Junction. IBM has a chip – had a chip manufacturing plant in Essex. IBM sold that plant or sort of offloaded it, sort of gave money away to Global Foundries. And that's an Abu Dhabi-owned corporation. It's through a subsidiary. And Global Foundries just received $1 million from that fund. Why?
Well, you're right, Jane. The fund had been established in advance of a possible sale of the IBM facility and the concern that we had that perhaps that sale could result in significant job loss. Mercifully, or happily, Global Foundries acquired the plant, and so we're very happy to have an actual chip maker who wants to be in the chip making business making chips in Essex Junction. But the Global Foundries scenario is a little different than IBM, and Global Foundries has chip fabs, as they call them, in Essex Junction, East Fishkill, a couple in Singapore, and another in Dresden, Germany. And these plants each have to compete with themselves for new investment, for product line. And as Janet Bombardier, the site manager here, explained to the emergency board and others, they compete on a cost per unit. They call it actually a cost per mass level. Please don't ask me to explain that. But so to the extent that they have competitive disadvantages with some of their partners, we need to try to help offset that. So those 3,000 plus jobs that are in Essex Junction, high paying jobs, are secure. And the $1 million is being leveraged by $72 million investment that Global Foundries is making in Essex Junction that will be specifically used in efficiency operations at the plant, which will help them compete with their sister plants in other parts of the world. And I think we need to remember that. We are in a global marketplace. This company has to compete literally with its own own sister plants and other companies to make sure that the chips that are in all of our cell phones – so if you want to help create jobs in Vermont, buy more cell phones. It's a good thing. But also so that they can make sure they're meeting delivery schedules, that they've got the product ready when the phone is ready to be manufactured, and that they can do it in a price competitive way. And they literally rank cost of electricity per mass level, cost of property taxes, you name it. And so this is an effort to help them compete as a facility here in Essex Junction.
I should also mention here that my husband works for Global Foundries. He's in production in that Essex Junction fab. We got a note from Bruce who says, so not only did IBM pay Global Foundries to buy the manufacturing plants, but now the state is kicking in money as well. Wow. And Mark says, I thought the purpose of the Enterprise Fund was to provide meaningful incentives for existing businesses to create new jobs and to stay in Vermont. Given the relatively small overall dollar amount in this fund, my opinion is it should only be given to businesses where the money offered to them will make a real and true difference to the operation. I think any reasonable person would argue that that is a litmus test that must be passed before any business is given money from the Enterprise Fund. After all, what is $1 million or even $4 million to a company like Global Foundries? It's not like that would keep them from shutting down their operation in Vermont and moving to where the labor and fixed costs are cheaper. And Paul Cielo, as Secretary Moulton said, this $1 million from the State Enterprise Fund is part of a $72 million investment that Global Foundries is making in that manufacturing plant in Essex. What's your perspective on that award?
Well, I agree with the individuals that are writing in. I think as Doug Hoffer said earlier, the Global Foundries announced their investment before the state put up $1 million, and it's hard to imagine that $1 million is actually going to make much difference to Global Foundries. But I think the more important issue is that it's the wrong conversation. That I can understand Secretary Moulton, and she should be engaged with businesses that in conversations about locating in Vermont. But I think the conversation really should, in terms of state investments of dollars, should be about investments that benefit all Vermonters and that can't just leave when Global Foundries decides a couple of years from now that they can't be here anymore for whatever the – and we've seen this in the past that, you know, business – all over the country that businesses pick up and leave, and despite having received federal and state benefits. So I think we would like to see our limited dollars in Vermont, tax dollars, go to investments that create a an opportunity for businesses to thrive in the state, but that also benefit the people who live here, and as opposed to individual businesses and just essentially giving money that goes to their bottom line, which is really what this is.
And if I could, and I agree with Paul, we need to continue to make investments in infrastructure, broadband, et cetera, that are going to make us a competitive place to do business. And we do that on a regular basis all throughout state government, but also in our agency. We have community development block grant program that helps make investments around affordable housing, infrastructure, et cetera. And that is important. But we have to keep in mind, again, we are competing. Our businesses are competing on a global level where literally every penny counts. And Vermont is competing with other states to retain what we have as well as attract new businesses.
But a $72 million investment that Global Foundries had already announced it was making in the Essex plant, it had already made many of the long-term temporary jobs permanent, which don't come with more benefits in many cases and do come with a slight increase in salary. But they had all, Global Foundries had already said it was making these investments. So does that $1 million, was that a promise that they already knew they had? Or do you think that really makes a difference?
Yes, I do think it is makes a difference. It wasn't a promise that was already made. The company had announced their $55 million investment and the conversion of 50 what they call long-term supplementals, temps, to full-time, and then said we will spend another $17 million and convert another 50 long-term supplementals to full-time. It's for a total investment. And the company was clear in their application to the emergency board that there were circumstances such that they could not come in for these funds prior to the time that they did come in. We were actually hoping it'd be before the emergency board in December, but the board asked us to put this off until January for scheduling purposes. So, and Janet Bombardier provided testimony at the emergency board that she doesn't actually have those 50 long-term supplementals on staff yet, so she can't convert them until she can hire. There's some 50 to 60 job openings at any given time at Global Foundries. It's finding the right people with the right skills, the right math knowledge, et cetera, that are going to help her make that conversion. And Vermonters need to keep in mind, yes, we've spent $1.7 million, but we're leveraging $92 million investment by these companies, 248 direct jobs from these three businesses, and 326 indirect or induced jobs. And those numbers come from a cost-benefit model we're required to run on each company as part of their application for the enterprise fund. I would argue that is a benefit to the state of Vermont, and that doesn't necessarily count all the subcontractors and small businesses that support these businesses. So I believe we are making an investment that supports all Vermonters, but I do support Paul. We have to continue to make those investments that makes Vermont a good place to do business. But let's not forget, we're still competing.
I want to get to a couple of calls here because we have listeners who've been waiting on the line, like Wade in Huntington. Hi, Wade. Go right ahead.
Hi. It's Wade from Huntington, but that's okay. The longer this conversation goes on, the more confused I get. And I have a couple of questions for Secretary Moulton. You say that it's unfortunate that all these the states in the country with many more millions of dollars do this for incentives, and Vermont can't possibly compete with them. But we need to continue playing the game, even though we can't possibly win it. I don't understand that. Two, when do these jobs have to be created at companies that get these awards? And how long do these jobs have to be maintained once the award is given? And I don't want to disagree with you directly, but I believe that shortly after the IBM, either after IBM announced they were selling the plant or shortly after the agreement with Global Foundries, the governor made a promise of $1 million a long, long time ago.
Wait, let's put those to Secretary Moulton because you've got good questions there. And as I mentioned, the fund was created with IBM in mind. So this money was always thought of in some ways as dedicated to that fabrication plant. But Wade had other questions for you as well.
Yeah, let me just speak to that, Jane. You're right. The fund was created to respond to a potential sale of IBM. But there are differing opinions as to whether that was the only place the funds should be spent. And so you can ask probably 10 different people, get 10 different answers. But to your point, Wade, while we can't compete on the same level with a New York or Massachusetts who literally throws hundreds of millions of dollars of incentives, New York, there was another company, $125 million incentive. We can't compete at that level, but we can compete in a number of other factors, not just that we have incentives and including the enterprise fund as a resource, but that we have a qualified workforce, that we're a competitive place to do business, that we are accessible to major markets in Canada and the U.S. So that's why companies choose to locate here or choose to expand here. But they also look at every bottom line aspect of that expansion and try to make a determination, will it be here or will it be elsewhere? To your second question about when the jobs, yes, we have grant agreements that are actually in process as we speak that are very clear. And the memoranda to the emergency board explaining the incentive were very clear about timelines that jobs have to be created, what happens if jobs are lost within a certain period of time after the expansion has occurred, and recapture of those provisions. They're different with all three companies. I can say in the case of Global Foundries, the money will not be expended until they've made those investments, until the 100 jobs have been converted. So those performance measures are included in the grant agreements that we will be having with these three companies.
And then those jobs have to be retained for how long in that case?
It varies with each particular company. There are clawback provisions if they have mass layoffs within, I believe it's a year, 2 years, 3 years. And then after that point, we have every expectation that they're going to remain here. But you know, Paul's right. It's a competitive marketplace. Companies can't guarantee today they're always going to be here. But we also know that the revenue that's generated through the income taxes, sales taxes, et cetera, that from the jobs that are created in the companies will help create more revenue for the state of Vermont. In fact, these projects will create over 5 years, just 5 years, in excess of $3.5 million in revenues to the state. So for $1.7 million, we get $3.5 million short term and far more than $3.5 million long term.
Paul Cielo, I'm going to let you have the last word here.
First of all, I think that Wade is right, that we really can't compete with other states on this basis. And we always hear these promises about why this investment is actually going to pay off. I want to mention, though, before we wrap up today, is that there's a new report out today that we published on our blog on our website at publicassets.org that actually uses 18 years actually, of data, longitudinal analysis that looks at business growth and job growth all over the country. And what it points to is that these incentives, these financial business financial incentives, do not work, that they don't deliver the results, and that the money is much better spent on the kinds of investments that actually benefit the people who live in these states.
That's Paul Cielo. He's president and executive director of the Public Assets Institute. And we were joined today as well by Patricia Moulton, secretary of the Agency of Commerce and Community Development. Thanks very much to you both.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
Coming up, Zika virus is spreading fear in pregnant women all over the Americas, including in this country, where the virus and the mosquitoes that carry it are expected to spread. Coming up, we'll talk with the state entomologist about why he thinks it's unlikely that Vermont mosquitoes will be a vector for the disease. And we'll hear from the health department about what it's doing to monitor the situation. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Concern over the Zika virus has been growing as more countries report cases. The primary worry is the effect the virus has on fetuses of pregnant women who are bitten by mosquitoes that carry the virus. Officials in the United States expect mosquitoes in this country to be able to transmit the virus as well, making many pregnant women very worried. And just this week, Texas officials reported the first proven case of sexual transmission. So now we're going to find out what Vermont health and agriculture officials are doing to keep on top of this evolving issue. We're going to talk with state entomologist Alan Graham and to state epidemiologist Patsy Kelso. Thanks to both of you for being here.
You're welcome.
So, Alan Graham, what mosquitoes are actually transmitting this virus?
There are the primary mosquito vector is Aedes aegypti, and it's a tropical species that probably arrived in this country around 1600, sometime in the 1600s when ships were making trips back and forth.
And that is in this country, but is it in Vermont?
It's not in Vermont. It does get have a distribution in Florida and through Georgia and a little bit into South Carolina.
Is that the only mosquito that's likely to be able to carry Zika virus?
There's a second species that's named Aedes albopictus, and that species has a wider distribution, and its ability to transfer the virus is not clearly known, but it's suspected to be a fairly good vector species.
And you said that's more widespread.
That's more widespread. That particular species is now found as far north as New Jersey, a little bit on Long Island. It has a very hard time wintering over in southern Massachusetts and along the coast in Connecticut.
And it doesn't travel up here while it's alive?
No, it does not travel very well. It could, but it wouldn't build up very large populations.
Vermont has, what, 45 different types of mosquitoes?
That's right. Vermont has 45 different types of mosquitoes. The further south you go, they're more diverse the mosquito populations become.
And none of the 45 species that we have, you think, are likely to be able to carry and transmit Zika?
It appears to be highly unlikely, but I'm sure people will be doing studies. They're called vector competency, just to see how well the mosquito picks up the virus. There's a lot of things that have to happen. The virus has to be picked up by the mosquito, and there has to be enough virus picked up by the mosquito to make the mosquito infective. And therefore, not all mosquito species can do that. For some reason, some mosquito species are really good at picking up large amounts of virus and moving the virus through their bodies to their salivary glands where they're injected into a human. But that doesn't happen with many mosquitoes.
Dr. Patsy Kelso, most of the health effects that we are hearing about with Zika virus are on the fetuses of pregnant women when the women are bitten by infected mosquitoes. I think most people are pretty aware from the news reports of what happens, but just briefly, can you remind us what happens to those babies?
Right. So most of the health effects that we've seen in the affected countries have been cases of microcephaly. That's small heads and underdeveloped brains in these babies. There are some other poor pregnancy outcomes that may be associated. So problems with vision and hearing may also be associated with this infection in the mom. There's an increase of cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome in Brazil. The relationship between Zika virus infection and those cases is not well established, but we suspect that there's a link between Zika and this increase in Guillain-Barré in Brazil as well.
Alan Graham just mentioned that none of the types of mosquitoes that are native to Vermont are likely or thought to be able to be carriers for this virus. But what are you advising Vermont women to do?
So there's a few important things that Vermonters should be thinking about. Pregnant women, of course, should be well aware of the CDC recommendations to consider postponing travel to areas affected by Zika virus transmission. If they must travel, they should strictly follow steps to prevent mosquito bites in those areas. Women who are trying to become pregnant should certainly talk to their healthcare providers before they travel to these affected areas. And their healthcare providers can advise them things that they should do if they do go to these areas, certainly using contraception while they're there if they do decide to travel to these areas. And then women of childbearing age, generally, because half of pregnancies we know are unintended. So women of childbearing age who don't intend to become pregnant but go to these Zika-affected territories and countries should also use contraception while they're traveling just because, they may become pregnant unintentionally.
Mosquito bites, though, aren't the only way that this virus is transmitted. It was just reported that the virus has proven to be transmitted through sexual contact. How are you advising women about that concern?
We don't expect to see, as Alan has been saying, transmission of Zika virus in Vermont. We do expect to see some sporadic cases in travelers who go to these affected areas and then get infected there and come back to Vermont. And so, you know, this is a very rare mechanism of transmission for this virus. The vast majority of cases are through mosquito bites. There's also, you know, relatively rare transmission from mother to child, very, very rare transmission through sexual contact. But certainly if we have cases in returning travelers, healthcare providers can counsel those patients about their period of possible infectiousness and using condoms if they're having sex and other ways to prevent transmission.
Because again, a barrier method would be essential there. You're not just trying to prevent conception.
Correct.
Alan Graham, there are unlikely then to be mosquitoes, native mosquitoes, getting and transmitting Zika virus here in Vermont. But could people bring back, not only bring back their own infections, but have a mosquito hitch a ride in luggage or in cargo and have it get here so we have a few mosquitoes that are basically just travelers in Vermont that have Zika virus?
Well, that is a possibility, but I think it's fairly remote. Mosquitoes, we don't have any direct flights to the tropics that I know of from Vermont, and therefore I don't know how well a mosquito would travel inside a suitcase. But I think, having said that, I think it's highly unlikely. The more port of entries would be the larger metropolitan airports.
Well, and Quebec, Montreal is not far away.
Montreal is not far away, but the mosquito populations wouldn't be able to become established.
Dr. Kelso, the CDC has temporarily recommended that pregnant women use insect repellent with DEET if they're in mosquito-heavy areas. Usually, pregnant women are advised not to use DEET while they're pregnant because of potential risks of the chemicals in those mosquito repellents. Should pregnant women in Vermont use DEET this summer?
Again, we don't anticipate having Zika virus transmission in Vermont this summer or anytime soon. Having said that, we don't, you know, currently have any actual precautions against using DEET in pregnancy. What we recommend for protection against the mosquitoes that can spread Eastern Equine Encephalitis virus and West Nile virus in Vermont, which is a concern, is that all Vermonters, pregnant or not, should use an EPA-registered insect repellent, and they should follow the instructions on the label. So as long as the person is using it according to instructions on the label and applying it as frequently as the label recommends, it should be safe to use.
So basically, the health department is not recommending any elevated precautions for Vermonters and particularly women of childbearing age or women who are or may become pregnant. You're not having any elevated precautions that you're recommending women take while they're in state.
That's correct. Just being aware if they do plan to travel.
Alan Graham, will the state be doing anything differently this late spring and summer in terms of mosquito monitoring and testing or even mosquito spraying in light of concerns over Zika?
No, we will, that is one concern that we don't have. We are concerned about other diseases carried by ticks and mosquitoes, and Zika virus is not likely to be a concern in Vermont other than what Dr. Kelso said, with travelers that have gone to areas with Zika virus present.
So you mentioned that you think some researchers and entomologists will be doing studies on different species to see their potential for being carriers. That's not something the state of Vermont is carrying out.
No. You would need insect rearing facilities and access to the virus and amounts, and that's something we wouldn't be doing.
Dr. Kelso, are you at the health department receiving calls from concerned people or concerned women in Vermont? This seems like something, it's not new, but it's become a very large issue and perhaps a growing one, certainly a growing one. Are you getting calls from people who are worried?
We are getting calls, not a large number, but we are getting calls from people who are planning to travel. Some of them are pregnant, some of them not. You know, we're providing guidance. We issued a health advisory to healthcare providers last week with guidance and recommendations so that they know what to pass along to their patients, who should be tested, that kind of thing. And so we are getting some calls where we're able to provide the necessary recommendations so far for the types of calls that we've been getting.
Anything else the state is doing that Vermonters should be aware of or that you'd like to pass along as we have this conversation sort of at the height of people's concern and worry? Dr. Kelso?
I think this reminds us that, you know, it's a very global world, and there are new diseases and diseases that are new to us that we're learning about all the time. And so it's great to travel. It's also great to remember that if you travel and you come back with an illness, talk to your healthcare provider about your recent travel, because there may be illnesses that we don't experience here all the time that are emerging from other parts of the world.
Patsy Kelso is the Health Department's Epidemiologist for Infectious Disease. Thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome.
And we're also talking with Alan Graham, the state entomologist. Thanks very much to you.
You're welcome.
That does it for today. Do you have a tattoo or a story about what your tattoo means? Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll be talking about the cultural history of tattoos and why the art of tattooing is enjoying a surge of popularity. We're also going to debunk a lot of myths about tattoos, so tell us about yours. Write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and send us a photo, and tune in tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.